CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Basil with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow looking at the Supreme Court, the docket now in front of us to be argued and decided. The case that I'm looking at now has turns on the general concept of religious liberty. The Supreme Court will hear the arguments. Maine education policy bars religious K through 12 schools from receiving state-funded tuition aid. Again, Richard, I come to you because this is very far from my reading of what John Adams presented as the ambition of the Vineyard of Liberty, the experiment of the Republic in the late 18th century. Religious schools were routine, part of the of how America prepared its next generation. In this particular instance, the facts are very, very simple. Parents have brought suit against the state saying barring religious schools from receiving state-funded funding violates the U.S. Constitution. It's very straightforward. Again, shared sovereignty would suggest that the state has the right to make its own rules here, and the parents are using the national government against where they live, the regional government. And yet there is this odd twist again and again that religion is extremely special to the Constitution and the founders. How can this be resolved in terms of shared sovereignty?
Well, again, what you have to do is to go back to the history. And if you read the First Amendment, the first word in the First Amendment is Congress shall make no law. And then it refers to with respect to the establishment of religion or the prohibition of the free exercise thereof. And so it looks as though what happens is you limit the federal government by the religion clauses and nothing else. The early application of this had to do with the Mormon cases, in which it turns out what they did is they said that polygamy was illegal in a case called Reynolds against the United States. Since it was involved with the Utah territories, it didn't involve any incorporation. But the incorporation movement, which is taking the guarantees that are drafted against the federal government in the Bill of Rights and carrying them over against the state, is one of the great constitutional transformations of the last century. And the way in which this all worked is you went through the due process clause or the equal protection clause of the federal constitution and said that certain things apply to the states. So in the religion, back in the 1940s, a case called Everson, and all of a sudden it turns out that states were subject to some kinds of restriction. And then in an amazing turn of events, what happened is Justice Black, who said the amendment applies to states, then proceeded to say that the activities that were given were not caught by the amendment because there was a legitimate secular purpose. As you move forward, everybody now kind of concedes that the federal government is an overlay, and then there's this huge question as to what you do about the use of preferences by way of state funding for religious education. The strict separation is, say, it's an establishment of religion to do that because you're taking public funds and giving it to a religious purpose. I think the argument on the other side is actually somewhat stronger, which is if you start looking at who puts this money into the pot, it's religious people as well as non-religious people. And to say, in effect, that religious institutions cannot receive these monies on equal terms with everybody else means that religious people have to pay for secular education, but secular people do not have to pay for religious education. So there's just a wealth transfer between one group and the other. And so a better way to look at this is to say, as you run this particular state program, is there any built-in bias which is designed to favor religion or to oppose it? If you cut the schools out, as Maine is trying to do, it's clearly you're hurting religion. And the Supreme Court has faced this in a number of recent cases. And the prediction that I have is they will strike this down and come up with a non-discrimination rule which says that unless you could find some very, very strong reasons, you can give aid to religious institutions or secular institutions with religious overtones, as is in Maine, and not run afoul of the First Amendment, which has been carried over, notwithstanding shared sovereignty, from the federal governments to the states.
My understanding is that the political forces in the country, especially in Washington right now, are primed to be upset and to introduce turbulence if and when the Supreme Court makes this or that decision. Do you anticipate a decision along these lines about the religious schools would rock the country?
There's only one case that really rocked the country on religion. There was a case called Engel and Vitale back in the early 1960s, in which there was a non-denominational prayer that was said in public schools, and what the Supreme Court said is that this was a violation of the Establishment Clause. That created a huge furor, because what it did is it upset very established practices, and people thought for no particularly good reason. In this particular case, the debate is sufficiently arcane, and the same issue has been decided several other times fairly recently, in which religious institutions have gotten an equal right to participate in these various programs, that I do not think that this will really stir up any huge kind of opposition. And there's nothing about it which is particularly abusive, given what I said. So I think that this one is not likely to have 1/10 or even 1/100th of the kind of response that you're going to see either to guns on the one hand or to the abortion cases on the other.
Yes, the abortion case is the one that dominates the headlines now because it has to do with a Mississippi case, not the Texas matter. I have this quote from Farrah Peterson, a colleague of yours, a legal historian at the University of Chicago Law School. The court's legitimacy rests on being able to show the public that a change in personnel does not mean a dramatic change of law, and that's what's going to be at stake at this term. Richard, the history of the Supreme Court is nothing but turbulence and challenge. Is that correct, or am I just thinking back as far as
I think Farrah basically, if you're in favor of the status quo, that's what you'd want to say. But if you go back to 1937, the maxim that came out was the switch in time that saved nine. That is, the survival of the Supreme Court was dependent upon a radical change in its direction so as to no longer thwart the Roosevelt programs in the way which had been done as recently as 1935. So I don't think that you can say legitimacy depends on either continuity on the one hand and disruption on the other. I think what it does is as follows. If you regard the current court as illegitimate, then you better fix it up and change passage quickly. And if you regard the current court as legitimate, then you don't want to change anything at all. The simple truth on this matter is that the country is deeply divided, pretty evenly on virtually all of these issues. So no matter which way you go, you're going to find some serious kind of objection. And the Democrats, in fact, are trying to use this in part to advance their program to court pack and try to add more justices of the Supreme Court to create a 7-6, a Democratic majority, a very transient thing, to put it mildly. And I'm strongly against that kind of a situation, because I think institutional continuity is what we want. And if you really want to destroy the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, what you do is you change the method by which people are chosen to it. The Republicans never tried to do it when they were in dominant. The Democrats previously had never tried to do it except for the court packing plan, which went down ignominiously. And I think, in effect, that the most important thing for the legitimacy of the Supreme Court is not to change the rules whereby its justices are selected.
And lastly, we have a minute. Justice Breyer, he in particular is being singled out by sharp voices as a man who should get out of the way. They say it more rudely, but I'm characterizing his term. Representative, you said in the past, he's the last liberal on the court. He's not in any way a person who wants to challenge or undermine the traditions of the court. Do you believe he'll withstand the pressure, Richard? We have 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, I think, the man is, I guess, now about 83. He's certainly entitled to retire. I think he's in good health. I don't think he wants to retire. Given the speech that he's given, saying in effect that he doesn't want to see the legitimacy of the court undermined by political attack, I think that he would regard it as almost catastrophic to resign at this particular point, as it would be seen as capitulating to pressure. So ironically, the more that they attack him, I think the less likely it is that he'll resign. And why do they want him to resign? Well, it's for two reasons. Many people on the progressive wing don't regard him as far enough to the left. And the other thing is they want to take somebody in 83, get him out of office now so they don't have a repeat of the situation with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where he dies in office and then the Republicans get to appoint somebody.
Professor,
it's going to be very tricky. Even if he does it at the end of this term, you're in an election year when the appointment have to take place.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.